Today, author and journalist David Wallace Wells on why the reality of climate change might be much worse than we imagine, and how Brexit uncertainty will impact a whole community.
In the weeks after the American election in 2016, I saw a really terrifying news article that said that temperatures in the Arctic Circle were 50 degrees warmer than they should have been at that time of year. It's the Arctic winter, and it was basically, temperatures were like, it was the Arctic summer.
David Wallace Wells is the deputy editor at New York Magazine.
I knew enough about global warming and what's called runaway climate change, which is when the climate system of a planet changes very, very rapidly, as happened on Venus, which went from being Earth-like to being totally uninhabitable very quickly a long time ago, to worry that that is what we were seeing. Not only were we seeing a political cataclysm, but we may be about to witness an environmental one.
Temperatures near the North Pole are climbing toward the freezing mark. While that may be cold for many places across the U.S., the average.
And the more that I started looking around, honestly, the scarier it got.
A few years ago, David started collecting stories of climate change. Shocking stories that were slipping under the radar. And the more he found, the more concerned he became that we weren't seeing or being given the full picture. And then, in 2017, he wrote a piece for the magazine about climate change. It was called The Uninhabitable Earth, and it opened with the line, "It is, I promise, worse than you think." It painted a shattering portrait of climate change's impact on our lives in the very near future, and it was read by millions.
We are not going to be Venus anytime soon, but some things that are quite unlike anything humans have ever experienced before on this planet are almost certain to happen, in fact, happening already, and what that means for life on this planet is enormous.
From The Guardian, I'm India Rakesson. Today in Focus, is climate change worse? Way worse than we think. A number of climate change reports have recently made worrying predictions about what's on our horizon. The reports usually first look at hundreds of possible scenarios, and then they use the median or the midpoint between the extremes. In David's research, he decided to look specifically at these more extreme scenarios that are less likely, but still possible. He talked to dozens of climatologists and researchers, and he read stacks of scientific papers. He looked at projections for things like the effect of heat, air pollution, sea level rise, the spread of disease. And now he's fleshed all of this out into a book, and it's not an easy read. David, you're not a scientist, you're not an environmentalist. Why did you do this?
Well, part of it is just that I'm a writer who's always been interested in the near future and in novelty and interested in sort of bigger trends of how our world is unfolding. And this was news that I didn't see being reported all that well in other outlets. You know, I grew up in the 90s in America. I was very much a child of the sort of end of the Cold War, the end of history. I believed that progress was erratic, but over time things did reliably get better and that market forces and globalization, as naive as it sounds now, were going to over time bring prosperity and peace and stability and health to the world. And I had sort of, you know, of course I understood climate change was a problem and I knew that it was going to be a difficult one, but I also just sort of expected that things would work themselves out. And the more that I learned about what was really happening to the planet, and especially how quickly, the more I realized that, in fact, all of those were deep delusions.
Okay, so why are we having this roller coaster then? Because above average mild temperatures, now below average. Why can't it just stick to the average? If only weather would behave.
Well, exactly. It's the atmosphere that's not behaving itself.
What was wrong with the stories that you were coming across? Why were they not being told well, in your opinion?
I think there were basically three shortcomings, which I think of as three misapprehensions. One was that climate change was slow and would arrive very far in the future. You know, we often think of global warming as the legacy of the Industrial Revolution, and therefore we think of it as something that is working on a time delay of several centuries, and something also that we're not ourselves responsible for. But in fact, more than half of all of the carbon that we've emitted into the atmosphere in the history of humanity has been emitted just in the last 25 years. And those 25 years, it's important to note, are the years in which we've known very clearly about what climate change was and what it would mean, so that we have now done more damage to the planet knowingly than we ever managed to do in ignorance. The other two major delusions that I saw were that climate change was happening far away, so that if you lived anywhere but the coast, you were basically safe. We now know from wildfires especially that this is not the case, but there are many, many other impacts that will hit people no matter where they live, in part because the impacts on, say, the growth of the economy or public health or even war are really dramatic. And then the third is just how bad it will get, how much temperature rise is possible. Most people writing about climate change up until a year or two ago were really reluctant to even consider what would happen at temperatures north of 2 degrees Celsius of warming. At the moment, I would say without a really dramatic technological innovation, 2 degrees is about our floor rather than our ceiling, which means that just about all of the likely outcomes for climate change were being left unexplored by that climate journalism.
David, what is the current situation? Where are we at?
We are about 1.1 degrees Celsius warmer than the pre-industrial baseline, which is what all of the warming temperatures are measured from. And that actually that doesn't sound like very much, but it actually means that we are now outside the window of temperatures that enclose all of human history. So never before have humans been around walking a planet that is as hot as this one. And it's actually an open question whether we would have evolved at all if the planet had always been this hot.
A dire warning this morning from climate experts. A UN panel says governments around the world must take rapid action to curb rising temperatures, or else millions around the world face future disaster. Margaret Evans joins us.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, is the United Nations body for assessing the science related to climate change. Last autumn, they released a report which got huge news coverage. They looked at the difference between a world at 1.5 degrees warmer and a world 2 degrees warmer.
Today's landmark report should leave you in no doubt about the links between extreme weather and climate change. And to prevent it becoming unpredictably dangerous, say the scientists, we have to keep warming below 1.5 degrees.
Well, that report came about because for a long time, this community of scientists had been really focused on 2 degrees Celsius, which meant that the world's policymakers were theoretically, although they didn't take much action on it, also focused on 2 degrees.
Almost more than anything, one little number matters.
You hear this target mentioned all the time.
People just talk about 2 degrees.
2 degrees.
2 degrees.
2 degrees.
2 degrees.
2 degrees Celsius.
But a number of smaller island nations said, actually, we will be completely screwed much sooner than 2 degrees. Can you please take a look at 1.5 degrees and tell us what that will be like? And the results were quite alarming. 2 degrees was much, much, much worse than 1.5 degrees. At just north of 2 degrees, we think the ice sheets will begin their irreversible melt. That is, if we get past about 2 or 2.1 degrees of warming, there will be no stopping the melting of all the Arctic ice.
No stop at all.
At all.
Completely irreversible.
It'll be impossible to stop. The rise is gradual. So by 2100, we may only see 8 feet or 10 feet is probably the north end of the projection, 3 meters. But it will flood hundreds of cities around the world over time and make uninhabitable much of the coastline of the world.
I have to say, when I read the book, I felt really physically dizzy at points. It was really overwhelming. Is that what you're intending?
Yeah, I think destabilizing people's sense of the world is really important, because we tend to think that the world as it is quite stable, and we tend not to take seriously predictions of dramatic change. And as a result, we don't do much to stop them or to address them. And I think once people understand just how completely the world could be transformed by climate change, we'll begin to take the threat much more seriously.
When the article first came out, there was a big backlash, and in that backlash, you were accused of being irresponsible, scaremongering.
We paint a pessimistic doomsday scenario for the planet. I began by asking,
an impact on the climate discussion in the United States, and has provoked a storm of criticism and pushback.
Scientists said that they'd purposefully avoided scaring people so as not to turn them off the issue. Do you think that criticism's fair?
Well, I think it's a sort of fair argument. But I don't agree with it. You know, I think there are a lot of reasons why scientists have been cautious in talking about climate change. Some of it is just temperamental. As scientists, they are very, very careful, and they understand that any exaggeration or hyperbole will be used against them. And they also often pointed to some social science research suggesting that in certain ways, these messaging built around hope and optimism was more motivating than fear and alarm. But I've read that research too, and I think it's much less authoritative than it's been interpreted as.
It really gets you when you talk about oceans, because sea levels are such a really familiar narrative, aren't they, when we talk about climate change. You wrote about Miami and Bangladesh were going to be gone even if we cut all emissions now.
Yeah, again, that'll take time, but I think there's no hope for making them permanently livable without massive seawalls and infrastructure investment, and I don't think...
From now, that's inevitable.
Yeah, it's bleak.
There was a bit of sort of this list of what sounded like just sad goodbyes in the book of things that were going to head underwater, including like the Vatican and every beach you've ever been to.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a portrait. When you look at what 4 degrees of warming will bring, which is the path that we're on by the end of the century, should we not take action, it really is a world completely transformed.
Tell me about that heat and what impact will just the heat have?
Well, heat on the human body, there's a natural limit for what the human body can take heat-wise. But the scale of that impact is going to grow so dramatically. At about 2 degrees, it's estimated, which is where we'll likely be by the middle of the century and possibly even by 2040. Many of the biggest cities in India and the Middle East will be literally unlivably hot.
Just Europe that's in the grip of unusually high temperatures.
A heat wave that is sweeping India is being blamed for at least 750 deaths.
More than 50 degrees Celsius in the United Arab Emirates Wednesday. That was the highest temperature.
It will mean that you will not be able to make the pilgrimage to Mecca, and really a whole band of the planet will become basically unlivable in just 30, 40 years. Estimates for how many climate refugees we'll see by 2050 are at least as high as 100 million. Some people think 500 million or even a billion, which is as many people live in North and South America combined. And the impacts of that on our politics and our culture would be enormous. I don't think we've really begun to think about those impacts. But there are also other direct impacts of heat. Heat impacts the yields of agriculture. So food, you know, we'll have about twice as many people on the planet, we think, by 2100 as we have today. And grain, which is the staple crop for most of the world, could be only half as productive. So we'd have half as much grain to feed those twice as many people.
Whilst a lot of the book is looking at predictions and forecasts for climate change, a huge amount of it is about what's happening right now. Like, we are in this, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, we just went through an incredible summer. So many more hurricanes, so many more wildfires, a global heat wave, unprecedented.
Pakistan has declared a state of emergency in the midst of a crushing heat wave that has already killed 800 people.
People dying from direct heat in Canada, in Russia, in the Middle East. There we had the incredible American wildfires in California.
To another record-setting fire season.
Now the largest in state history.
Really, there's no end in sight.
It's hot.
In Asia, there was Typhoon Mangkhut. There were historic rains in Japan. Worst flooding in Kerala, India, as had been seen in 100 years.
Hundreds of people have died. More than a million have fled their homes. The quantity of rain was unprecedented. 2.5
Really, it's just the beginning. You know, people often look at the news and they're horrified because they think this is our new normal. But in fact, it will get worse. There is no way that it won't get somewhat worse. The question is just how much worse it will get from here.
How does all of this make you feel? You've been living and breathing it for years.
Well, the first answer I would give is activated, energized, motivated, more politically radical. Of course, like anybody who sits with this material, it can also be really horrifying and depressing and despairing. I talked recently with Al Gore, who told me that he has many dark nights of the soul, and he's sort of the most temperamentally technocratic, optimistic, we can fix this people that I've ever met.
Despite some world leaders dismissing climate change,
the United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
There is a global effort to curb carbon emissions. The Paris Agreement was agreed and signed by 195 states back in 2015.
No major industrial nation in the world is on track to meet its Paris commitments. And even if all of them did, it would take us still to over 3 degrees of warming.
If we've got like 12 years to half emissions, it took them 2 years to sign a rule book on how that would be done.
Yeah.
And that feels very slow.
Yeah. And when you think about what it would take to have emissions, I mean, it's rebuilding all of our infrastructure, completely reimagining our energy systems, our transportation systems, our agriculture. Even when we have great news from green energy, we seem not to be using that to reduce our carbon footprint, but just to add to our energy capacity.
These are a lot of problems, and it's kind of fair to say that you're very in-depth on problems, but perhaps a bit shorter in the solutions. Why is that?
Well, I think the solutions are pretty clear. Political power to bring about radical decarbonization, as the UN has said, at the scale of World War II. The problem there is not what the solution is, it's getting there. And I think voting is by far the most important thing that anyone can do. If you want to live in accordance with your climate alarm and your climate principles and you want to eat less meat and fly less, that's great. But by far the biggest impact you can have is politically. And that is an obvious, you know, solution screaming out right in front of us. Now, I'm skeptical, given how much is involved in the decarbonization that's necessary, that we'll be able to get there in time to really forestall some of the worst impacts of warming, which is why I'm also growing more optimistic by necessity about carbon capture, which is technology that sucks carbon out of the atmosphere and stores it in some way.
There have been problems with getting some of this technology, like carbon capture, off the ground, beyond just the cost of it. So who is looking into possible solutions?
And many different people are looking into many different angles of it. You know, the green energy boom has been dramatic. There are many companies that are very aggressively driving down the price of solar power, wind power. Weird to say, but Elon Musk has been a hugely important figure in driving battery technology. But there are also weirder solutions. So in small scale studies, it's been shown that if we feed cattle seaweed, that their methane emissions fall by as much as 95%.
Wow.
So we could just legislate that all beef had to be fed seaweed.
Do you think these solutions, though, just detract from the bigger picture?
I mean, I think that the impact of an individual's diet is quite trivial and, yes, can be a distraction from political action. But I also think that if everybody in the world was eating lab-grown meat as opposed to pasture-raised meat, that would have a meaningful impact on our global carbon footprint. But I think ultimately that will be determined less by individual choices and more by policy.
There is, of course, the big taboo about the fact that global population is growing very fast, and that contributes to climate change. And should we be having more children? You had a child while you were working on all of this. What's your answer to that?
Well, I do think that the math is clear that more people is harder for the planet to sustain. And yet, I do think it's completely within the realm of manageability for us to get to 10 billion people or 12 billion people and still have a stable climate if we got there in the right way. I think that personally, while I was concerned about what life on planet Earth would be like in 2080 and 2100 before I had a child, having a child has made those years much more vivid to me. You know, to use a weird metaphor, it gives you some skin in the game.
Do you think we're too late?
Well, I think without really large-scale investment in negative emissions, I think that we're too late to avoid, I would say, certainly 2 degrees, likely 2.5 degrees, and probably 3 degrees of warming. I mean, the IPCC, in their, you know, modeling, I think they modeled 400 scenarios where we stay below 2 degrees, and 344 of them have dramatic negative emissions technologies involved. So basically, the conventional decarbonization route, where we just make everything green, has a very, very slim, I would say zero chance of getting us below 2 degrees. Really important to keep in mind, no matter how bad it gets, it could always get more bad or a little bit less bad. And how much worse it gets or how many impacts we avoid will always be entirely up to us in that very moment. So in 2080, we're still affecting the climate of 2090 and 2100, and it will still be almost entirely within our own power to avert more suffering and to save more lives. So really, it's never too late, even though it's also already too late, if that makes sense.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more on The Uninhabitable Earth, head to theguardian.com, where you can read an extract of the book and read David's interview with global environment editor Jonathan Watts. Coming up, last weekend, Nissan's U-turn on production in the northeast of England brought the realities of a no-deal Brexit sharply into focus. What will the impact be on this region? Now, this weekend, Japanese car manufacturer Nissan announced they were withdrawing production of a new model from Sunderland in the northeast of England, saying uncertainty surrounding Brexit was part of their decision. In the wake of Nissan's announcement, Helen Pidd, The Guardian's North of England editor, reports back on how this U-turn might affect the area.
So Nissan opened a factory in Sunderland in the northeast of England in 1986. They employ 7,000 people directly, and there's an estimated 40,000 extra people employed in the supply chain across the UK. Therefore, it was a surprise to some from outside that 61% of people in Sunderland voted to leave the European Union. Many of them work for Nissan. And on the night of the vote, there were many reports coming out that there was cheers from the production line when the Sunderland result came in. I mean, they're not daft. They know exactly where the cars they are producing end up. 75% of their cars are exported to the European Union. And many of the Nissan workers that I've spoken to over the past few years, they didn't really envisage a Brexit whereby trading would become difficult and exporting would become difficult. It was more about getting back control of our decisions. This enormous pride in the product that they produce in Sunderland, they just felt that they can do that without Europe. So in the aftermath of the Brexit vote in October 2016, Nissan announced that it was going to build two new models in Sunderland. Many Brexiteers in Sunderland felt very vindicated by that decision. They said, see, we told you, Nissan is not going to stop investing in us. However, on the weekend, word leaked out via Sky News that Nissan had had a change of heart.
Please hold.
I decided to call Councillor John Kelly.
Did you hear me then? So it's Helen Pitt here from The Guardian.
Hello, Helen.
Hi.
Hello.
He has been a Labour councillor for 9 years and he represents Washington North, which is the ward in Sunderland where the Nissan plant is. And he describes himself as a Brexiteer.
It's a disappointing announcement. It's disappointing that it was leaked.
And he was clear that it was, of course, very, very disappointing. And he was definitely willing to accept that Brexit played a part in the decision from Nissan. And he said that, talking to his constituents in Washington North, it's the government that they feel exasperated with.
Most people aren't blaming Nissan. Most people are blaming the government. They're bemused by it all. They cannot work out how you've got all these ministers. We just do not have a plan. We don't even have a no-deal plan in place. It's just really, really embarrassing.
And he's particularly worried about the ramifications of a no-deal Brexit for Sunderland.
Compromise. I mean, you know, I'm a Brexiteer, but I don't want to leave without a deal.
Which he thinks would be absolutely catastrophic and will potentially completely paralyse production.
Well, it's the fact that our supply chains and all the rest of it will not work. I mean, everything they do
at Nissan is supplied on a just-in-time basis, sort of 24-hour turnaround, and there's thousands of lorries that arrive at Nissan and its biggest suppliers each day, providing just the number of parts they need. So even a tiny delay in the customs process in terms of arriving in the UK could really, really cripple Nissan. And in that scenario, 7,000 people lose their jobs. And the 40,000 people in the supply chain are also going to be in serious trouble. Everybody from the workers who are fabricating the car doors down to the cleaners who are sweeping the factory floor, the butcher who's providing the meat for the canteen. It's an enormous number of people whose livelihoods would really be imperiled.
I would say that there's this sort of received wisdom, particularly among Remainers, that it was the areas which voted most strongly for Brexit which will be most affected by it. And Sunderland is often a place that comes up in those kind of conversations. And yet, there is actually little evidence of regret or remorse around the vote. It's more a fairly recent realisation that we're hurtling towards no deal. And that is really what they're worried about right now. Their ire is all directed towards politicians. And they just want them to crack on and provide some certainty. And then they can carry on doing what they do best, which is producing cars.
That's it for today. Thank you to Helen Pidd and to David Wallace-Wells. Today's programme was produced by Lucy Greenwell and Rose de Larabiti. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll see you tomorrow.
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage and more. Plus, we're now offering an additional 50% off our 3-month subscriptions. Only when you subscribe before the 17th of February. Just search Guardian Subscriptions.